Society. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null. Not too fancy,
but hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. Monday to Friday, 3 to 4 p.m., we're here to share insights on how to live a longer and healthier and a happier life. Today, my guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Peter Bregan. We're going to talk about the problems with psychiatry, mental illness, all these drugs we're taking. 25% of all women in the United States are taking psychiatric drugs. Why? Did something suddenly happen to this last generation, to their brains? No. It's just one more way to pathologize life. So we're going to push back. We're going to show you how to get off those drugs and why you shouldn't be putting them into your body to begin with, and also how to stop the drugging of our children, which is an epidemic level. Also, the latest on health and nutrition and healing, new information on watercress, olives, olive oil. And then from our issue segment today, we're going to talk about how some believe that we're only a year away from global riots. Why? Because according to complex systems theorists, we just can't sustain it anymore. We just have too much poverty, oppression, and disenfranchisement, and food's going to go through the roof, and those people who cannot eat are going to riot. We'll give you a heads up on that. Also, from our environmental segment today, we're going to look at how your college is selling out to Big Agra, major university, to become de facto research and development and a marketing outpost for companies like Monsanto. That's not a good thing. We'll do that. Let us begin. Watercress is a little tart. It's crunchy. It's delicious. You generally put some watercress into a salad to bring up the boredom of the rest of the leaves that you're eating, which generally have very little taste. And then you put some fresh lemon juice on that, and you can put a little cayenne, a little black pepper, which is very good for you, and with biopurine in the pepper, and a little Himalayan pink sea salt, and some tomatoes that you have marinated for about an hour in apple cider vinegar. Now that's a good salad. But most people are not going to have the watercress part, A, because it's almost used for nothing except a garnishment in restaurants. But don't throw it away. Instead, start to have, on a daily basis, some watercress. Why? It's in the cruciferous vegetable family. Now, like broccoli and, let's say, we can use cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, asparagus, mustard, which, by the way, is very healthy. All of that helps prevent cancer. Lessons are likely to breast cancer, prostate cancer. In fact, it has a long history. The early Romans and the ancient Persians used watercress as a brain food, a nerve tonic, and an aphrodisiac. And it's the raw leaves that offer the highest nutrient. You can juice it also. You can put it in soups. So what you're going to get when you eat watercress is you're going to have a lot of the lutein, which helps improve and maintain eye health, including the macula. It's also very high in iodine, which can help if you have a thyroid problem. And also it has enzymes that are important for helping your liver to manufacture and transfer glutathione to our body's cells. Now, I'm sure this audience knows that glutathione is the master antioxidant in your body. It replenishes and recycles spent antioxidants for more activity and protects yourself against oxidative stress. So watercress each day. I believe in having olive oil and olives at the primary meal of the day. Now, I've traveled throughout the world, and I study in cultures to see what in their lifestyle, in their diet, in their behavior allows them to live a longer and healthier life than those in the United States. And I first became aware of this on a trip that I'd taken to England. And this was in the early 70s, and I was interviewing three leading nutritional doctors, the most famous in Europe at that time, Dr. John Yudkin, Dr. Cleve, and Dr. Burkitt, a Burkitt's lymphoma. And they all believed that what we needed was a higher fiber diet. But they wanted us to have roughage, not just fiber. So if you ate more root vegetables like rutabaga and parsnips and turnips, you'd be much healthier because your body would vacate food at a quicker level. And the American diet at that time only had about 3 to 5 grams of fiber, so we were always constipated. And the longer the food stays in your body, the more toxic it is. You want to get it through. Now, the ideal is, as you eat food, after that meal, you should pass the digested food from the previous meal. That's ideal digestion and elimination. So they were into fiber. They didn't take vitamins. They didn't juice. And they weren't vegetarians. And from there, I went over to Italy. And what was remarkable in the countryside in Italy was I'm sitting there. I asked a man, I said, if I help you today with your gardening, will you give me the benefit of learning about your lifestyle? I said, sure. He must have thought I was crazy. Spent all day working, and these people just work very slowly but very methodically. And they have really strong legs, and because they're up and down these hills. There's no flat area there where I was. It's like at the Alps, the base of the Alps, the Italian Alps. And as we're sitting there at the table, his wife brings out this large plate of olives. And I'm going to guess there were at least 20 different types of olives. And then she had homemade bread. And in the middle of this serving platter was about a quarter inch of a deep oil, an olive oil. And then there were spices in it. Now, normally, I never eat bread. I don't eat any gluten. But I thought, what the heck? I want to be, you know, courteous to them. And it's natural. They grow their own wheat, and they process it by stone grinding. And I actually got to see how they ground this thing. It's really neat. It's as if it was a 500 years ago. But the farm was 700 years old. Could you imagine going into a farmhouse that's 700 years old? They had this very long hardwood oak dining table. And at the far end of the table, the grandparents ate. They were in their 90s. Then their children, who were in their late 60s and 70s, and then their children, who were in their 40s and 50s, then their children, who were in their 30s, and their children, who were teens or younger. All these generations at one table. And I wasn't used to spending 3 hours around a dinner table and then being leisure afterwards. You know, in America, we eat everything quickly, and then we get right back to work. Not here. So while we're eating, I'm watching just the absolute unconditional love, the sparkle of energy between the grandparents, because I was seated beside them. And here was this dog running all over the place all day and now sitting there at the table. And I said, how old's your dog? And he's all 25. I thought, 25 years old. Your dog? He said, yes. He says, we have 2 dogs and we have 3 cats. And the cat, one of the cats is 30, one's 27, one's 25. And one dog's 25 and one's 20. So I went out to their barn and I'm looking at these animals. And I'm looking in their mouth, I'm looking at their gums and their teeth. And looking in their eyes. And then I'm watching how strong and agile and no pain. And so I threw my buddy, who's a physician and Italian, who was acting as the translator, my older brother was also on this trip with me as well, a simple question. In the United States, a dog that lives 15 is considered exceptional. Most die between 7 and 11. Most cats live between 9 and 12 years. Yours are more than twice that and still going. And he told me, he says, well, what do you feed? I guess you feed them box food or canned food. We don't. We feed raw food. What would an animal eat in nature? Raw. And he's talking about this. And he says, take a look around you. And I had not paid that kind of attention. I should have. And for the next hour to two, he gave me a lecture about, our olive oil is raw. It's cold pressed. Now, it was stronger. If you eat the real virgin, organic, first cold-pressed oil, it's If you're not used to it, it almost tastes like car oil. It kind of looks like car oil. The stuff we get here has been filtered and frequently substantially processed for our palates. We're not used to that. Like, we're not used to brown rice in America. We're used to white rice. We're not used to real stone ground bread. We're used to white bread and white pastas. In any case, so he said, you will not see a meal happen in the country without them eating olives and olive oil and homemade bread. And he said, but our bread is rich. And he indeed was correct. I mean, you could see the whole wheat kernels in there. And he showed me where they ground it. And they ground it between two large stones, the way it historically been ground. Because you think that because they're in the country and they don't have a television and they hadn't been to college, that somehow they're just, you know, not that bright farmers. Think again. They're much healthier than their children in the city. In fact, virtually all the farms we stopped at on this particular trip, and I would run. I was doing 25 miles of training a day. I was training for the marathon, so they would be in a jeep behind me, my brothers and two of my buddies, and I'd be running, and then they would stop in each little hamlet. A hamlet might have 8 to 10, 12 homes, and the people had been there forever, and these hamlets are about a mile or two apart. And this was all throughout the Italian Alps. And then we did the same thing in Spain and in France and everywhere else. Anyhow, so what I'm finding is that they're always concerned about their daughters and sons who go off to the city, like Milan. And in fact, one of the people who were in our caravan, one of my long-term buddies, had a business colleague who lived in Milan. So fortunately, we had a chance to see how he lived and what their lifestyle was. And it was much faster pace and much more stressed and very little exercise. They took their time eating, and they did eat pretty healthy, but not the variety they have in the country. And this man takes me into his barn, and he's got all these bags, these just regular brown paper bags, but they're all written on them. And these are the mushrooms. So in all their different sauces every day in their soups, they throw in these mushrooms. Now, these are not culinary mushrooms. These are medicinal mushrooms because they have the knowledge, at least his wife had the knowledge, of which mushrooms you need for your eyes, for your brain, for your digestion. So you name the problem, they have their own apothecary. They have their own functional food pharmacy that they put into their food. By the way, the Taiwanese did the same thing, and the Chinese are famous for doing this, as are the Japanese. We're the ones who never do anything right, especially when it comes to diet. So in any case, I'm counting, and I count over 100 different mushrooms. Then we go into the forest, and he shows me all these mushrooms growing on logs, and when it's time to harvest, and which ones you eat and which ones you don't eat. And then he's got all these dried gooseberries. And a gooseberry is a little tart, really loaded with nutrition. It's a superfood. And all the other types of fruit. Now, because the seasons are not very long there, and it gets cold quicker because it's at a higher elevation than over on the ocean, on the Mediterranean, they get food and then they dry it. And he showed me the tomatoes. They sun-dry them, and then they marinate them. And in one area, this is all raw, by the way, he had jars, and each jar had sun-dried tomatoes and sun-dried peppers, but with different herbs and seasonings, and some were marinating in that jar for 3 months, some for 6 months, and he said that's what we use in the different pastas to make different sauces. And then his wife was smiling, and she said, you're used to eating French fries in America. She said, come over here. So I walked over, and she said, put your finger in there. So I'm thinking, okay. So I wash my hand, and I take my finger, and I stick it in the sauce. I didn't get burned. She says, real Italian cooking is slow, and it's done in layers. In America, you throw everything in the skillet at the same time, and then you put olive oil in, you cook it at a high temperature, and it tastes like nothing. She says, we start with our fresh tomatoes, and then we peel them, take the skin off, and that allows the nutrients to be released gradually, and it sweetens the sauce. And then we put garlic in, and we only cook it till it's translucent, never till it's dark. And she went through how she made her sauces, and they like varieties, so she had all kinds of different varieties. Well, the olives were the ones that really struck me. They barter. Everybody around there is a specialist at something else. And so in their wine cellar, they had about 12,000 bottles of wine. This was mainly red wines, but they also barter. So some people would bring them wines, they give them cheeses. But everybody has a lot to eat. And they don't eat a lot, but they have a lot. And it stays, because they're out in the country. They don't go into the market. They're almost 100% self-sufficient. And I watched as this one guy played the guitar, and someone else did something during this quiet time, and they went back to work. Then at about 8 o'clock at night, they had a small meal, different food completely. And I never saw anyone finish a meal with a dessert. Not once. They always finished with a fruit. And so I asked why. Why the pears, or why the plum? Just a single pear, or a single plum, or apple, or grapes, whatever. And the son says, he's in his 40s, he said, because it facilitates digestion. And when you get a plate, that's small. One item on the plate, unless it's an antipasto. But otherwise, they give you a small amount of pasta. And if they have fish, it's a small amount of fish. Now, if an average American looked at what you get in a traditional Italian farm, they would think, well, gee whiz, why don't you just get a plate and stack it all on there? That defeats the whole purpose. So they'll eat a dish, and then they'll talk, or they'll do something. They don't just sit down just eat until they're full. So it's a very de-stressing time. You're enjoying your family. And I found that so many different places I went. And when I was in Madrid and I was speaking, I was actually the house guest, big apartment. I mean, humongous apartment. Bigger than any apartment I've ever been in the United States. And this was not an exceptional apartment. This is, you know, they have big families, they have big apartments. And marble floors, really neat. And he took me down the market, and he bought cases of fresh tomato and lettuce, and then he stacked them out on his balcony and his fire escape. And then each day, you know, they had always plenty of fresh. And they took their time eating. But he said that because life is fast-paced in the cities compared to the country, he and his family go to the country regularly and spend all their August with their family. But they're always suffering from illnesses that people in the country are not. Flu and colds and arthritis. Because they don't use the medicinal herbs. And they don't eat all the variety of olives. Anyhow, those olives were phenomenal. And here in America, you rarely get olives. And we have too many processed and cooked foods. And I was just surprised until they showed me how many foods they eat that were not processed, not cooked, but dried and then rehydrated. Now, this is the latest on olives and olive oil. This is from the University of Bordeaux, which is in France, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. Here's what it says. Olive oil cuts stroke by 50% in the elderly. Quote, researchers at the University of Bordeaux looked at the medical records of 8,000 people, 65 and older, living in three French cities. All participants had no history of stroke and were monitored for 5 years. Olive oil use was categorized into moderate use, not at all, or intensive use, which meant they used it every day. They found those who regularly used olive oil for both cooking and as a dressing lowered the risk of stroke by 41% compared to those who didn't use it. So, very important. Now, if you like olive oil, make sure that you're getting only organic olive oil, and that either Spanish olive oil or Italian olive oil, because there's a lot of oil coming out of Italy and France that's soybean oil, with just a little bit of olive oil in it, and there's just a big scam. So make sure you're getting certified organic and cold pressed. And finally, increasing vitamin D adds years to your life and helps prevent colon cancer. This was published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and it was also published in PLOS One Journal. And here's what it says. It says that vitamin D represented a significant improvement in overall years of life. For 10 years, scientific evidence has been mounting to show that the vast majority of adults and many children are grossly deficient in circulating blood levels of vitamin D. Further proof is documented in PLOS One Journal to show the precise cellular mechanisms that help vitamin D lower risk of colon cancer. Here's the takeaway message. Check your vitamin D blood saturation. It's an inexpensive test, and then you can make adjustments. And if you're African American or if you're dark skinned, you absolutely have to do this because you may not be absorbing adequate vitamin D. So, vitamin D can add years onto your life, and it helps prevent heart disease and cancer. I'm Gary Nall. That's our health and nutrition segment, the first 25 minutes we like to do on that. Now from our environmental segment. And I believe that the more we know about our environment, the more we're able to do something good about it. This is from Tom Philpott from Mother Jones. How your college is selling out to Big Agra. Major universities have become de facto research and development and marketing outposts for companies like Monsanto. I'll quote this. Last week, the University of Illinois College of Agriculture, Consumer and Environmental Sciences in Champaign, Urbana, made a momentous announcement. It had accepted a large grant from genetically modified seed agricultural giant Monsanto to create an endowed chair for the Agricultural Communications Program. Excuse me. Now, that program runs the College of Communications. Monsanto's latest gift isn't its first area of expertise with prestigious colleges, including this one, which is located right in the middle of tens of millions of acres of fields planted with Monsanto's GMO corn and soybean seeds and treated with regular doses of the company's Roundup Ready herbicide. Monsanto donated hundreds of thousands to that same university for its Monsanto Multimedia Executive Studio, quote, to be used by faculty and staff of the college for presentations and seminars and for conferences involving companies and organizations with ties to the college and its mission, end quote. Nor is Monsanto the only gigantic food and ag company giving cash to universities. Just a cursory look at its college website turned up a recent paper touting a novel infant formula, quote, that boosts babies' immunity. But then you see it was funded by Nestle Infant Nutrition and co-authored by a researcher in its employ. Then there's this study, also at this university, which purports to show that soy protein, quote, alleviates symptoms of fatty liver disease. It's brought to you by grants from the agribusiness-aligned Illinois Soybean Association and SOLE, a joint project of agricultural giants DuPont and Bunge that calls itself the world leader in developing innovative soy technologies. So then what I did is I went further and I began to look at all these grants and where they went to and the professors they went to and the companies giving it. And then I looked at if a university has a department in agronomy, what percentage of that total funding for that department is paid for by Monsanto or one of the other companies in the business, like Syngenta or Dow or Pfizer? Here is just a simple list. 90%, 83%, 93%, 97%, 92%, 85%, 76%, 99.6%, and 94%. That means that the only reason that university has that department is because Monsanto or one of the other major people are funding it. And so when you hear that genetically engineered food is safe and effective. And it was published by a university. Did the university receive money from one of the biotech companies to do the funding? Did they write the article? In all likelihood, yes. That's why we should only eat organic, not anything genetically engineered. Because they bought off the universities. They own the universities. They're paying for the professors and chairmen of the department. And Big Pharma has been doing that for a long time in medical schools. Why do you think, for example, that 88% of medicine not only does not improve the quality of our lives and save us from suffering, it's the number one cause of death and injury in the United States, surpassing heart attack and stroke? And only 12% of American medicine really works and is exemplary. And you don't see any effort to change it because all of this goes to fill the bank accounts of Big Pharma. They control the curriculums. They control the state medical boards. They control everything involving our so-called healthcare system. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break and come back and have our guest, Dr. Peter Bregan, talk about psychiatric drug withdrawal strategies and dangers, and also the fact we've become a highly medicated society. Please stay with us. Back in a moment. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over and say hello to Dr. Peter Bregan. He's been called the conscience of psychiatry during his outstanding career to reform the mental health field. He is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist and a former consultant for the National Institutes of Mental Health. He's also one of the harshest critics of current conventional psychotherapeutic approaches in treating mental disorders in both adults and children, particularly the epidemic use of psychoactive drugs. And along with his wife, he is the founder of the Center for the Study of Empathetic Therapy, which is a nonprofit organization providing scientific-based information on dangers and adverse effects of psychiatric drugs. He's written a lot of books. His most recent is Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients, and families. And he also does an hour, really very popular program on the Progressive Radio Network over the Internet every Wednesday at 4 p.m., the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, gosh, Gary, it's really, really good to talk with you. And I want to thank you for the Progressive Radio Network and for the opportunity for me to have an hour show each week. It's just a wonderful thing, and I really appreciate that opportunity.
Just for a second, let me just explain something to this audience. Throughout my career, I've been on ABC Network, on radio. I had the most popular program in the history of ABC Radio on Sunday, and number one in America. And I chose to leave there, and on WMCNWR. I've also been on Pacifica for 35 years, the longest-running daily program in its history. And what I find is that everything changes, but not always does programming change or management change to be in synchronicity with the needs of society. Maybe they're in alignment with a certain segment, but more often than not, not with the larger issues. So 7 years ago, I founded the Progressive Radio Network with the idea that I couldn't be the only person out there who felt that I wasn't in really the right alignment with my message and the people I wanted to reach. And lo and behold, it has grown. In fact, there's a letter up on my website that people can read from David Ides, one of the co-founders of the Lyco search engine, and the founder of Voice America, which is the first major internet radio syndicator in the world. And it says that we had very quickly reached 10 million listeners per month with my radio show over the internet, number one in the world. And that was 5 years ago. And we've just been growing ever since. And with about 5,000 new listeners per day over the internet. And the average age is 35, a woman, college-educated, who listens to the program on the archives at night. And since that time, I began to bring other people like Michio Kaku and Helen Caldicott and Danny Schechter, all these wonderful human beings, Richard Martin, on and yourself, over 80 different hosts who also represent a progressive ideal, meaning they're not politically aligned. They're not selling anything to anyone. They're not trying to defend ideologies. They're about ideas. So I'm happy that you're part of it, and it exists, and I don't have to address the problems that other terrestrial stations do. And also, just for all the people listening, the future of radio is the Internet. These land-based stations will no longer exist in the very near future because the enormous overhead that it takes to pay rent and taxes and utilities, today with the technology we have, you could have a small little location and broadcast outstanding quality programming. We're doing it, and our audience dwarfs all of Pacifica combined. So, just a message. Get ahead of the curve where everything is going instead of trying to catch up. Peter, I want to share an announcement made this week by the nation's Surgeon General, Regina Benjamin, regarding the dramatic increase in suicides. During the last year, there were 30,000 suicides, and there have been many reports on the crisis of suicides among active military personnel and veterans. In her statement, this was the Federal Health Agency's solution: issue more federal grants totaling $55 million to increase suicide hotlines and hire more mental health workers through the Veterans Administration, improve screening for depression, and use Facebook to track suicidal messages. That's just, in my opinion, it's very short-sighted. She claims that this would save 20,000 lives during the next 5 years, about 4,000 annually. However, nowhere in her statement is any mention made of our present psychiatric protocol of prescribing more and more psychiatric medicines, proven with thousands of peer-reviewed data as a major cause of rising suicidal rates. It's estimated that in the military alone, 89% of soldiers diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder are on antipsychotic drugs. So I would begin this discussion with you critiquing what I've just shared from the Surgeon General's solution, and then comment on why there is such denialism in our federal health agencies about over-medication with psychiatric drugs as leading cause of suicide today. The forum is yours.
Well, you're absolutely right. The Army, for example, is the latest great source of revenue for the drug companies. I've heard estimates, Gary, of starting at a low of 20% of active duty soldiers on psychiatric drugs, and some people have been telling me that the figures are double that or triple that at times. We know that every veteran who gets diagnosed with having any kind of mental problem coming back is likely to be on 4 or 5 psychiatric drugs. One result, unquestionably, is the increasing suicide rate, but also the violence rate, because a lot of many psychiatric drugs are associated with agitation, anxiety, anger, loss of impulse control. In fact, what I'm repeating to you, including hostility and aggression, is right in the official FDA write-up for the antidepressant drugs. So there's no question about it. In the VA, there's been a study of suicide, and The more recent use of antidepressants was a major factor in suicide and people going to the VA. There's just no doubt about it, and especially when you look at soldiers, because very short-term clinical trials showed an increased rate of suicide attempts, a doubling in people up to age 24, and that's in these little trials that weren't intended to show suicidal behavior, and which are much too short-term and much too heavily controlled to give you the actual rates. So I don't think there's any question at all that suicide is being increased throughout the Western world, and in particular in the United States, by psychiatric drugs. And so is violence. I recently had a case in Canada of a 16-year-old taking Prozac. He got more and more agitated. He got more and more anxious. His mother took him back to the clinic, their big clinic in Canada and said, I think my son's getting worse on this drug. So they increased the drug dose by 50%, which is the tendency to respond in psychiatry with, if you complain, we'll give you more. And then this boy, a very short time after the increase in dose, out of the blue, stabbed to death another 16-year-old with a single blow to his chest, just totally impulsive. And the judge in the case listened to my testimony, listened to the local Manitoba testimony, where certainly he would have preferred to trust a local Canadian psychiatrist than myself from the U.S., but he said that the evidence supported my view on this, and he concluded, the judge, that the 16-year-old would not have committed the violence without Prozac. So these drugs do produce mayhem, murder, and suicide. There's just no doubt about it. And long-term, they're producing what I call chronic brain impairment. We haven't had a good concept for milder levels of chronic brain impairment, short of a full-blown dementia. And people on almost any psychoactive substance, and certainly almost any psychiatric drug for months and years, begin to lose some of their mental acuity. Their memory doesn't function as well. They notice they can't do more than one thing at a time. They can't multitask. They also notice that they'll get more irritable, their emotions are more unstable, and they may notice that they're actually losing interest and becoming more apathetic. But often it's the family who notices. Often it's the family who really notices, because the drugs prevent us from realizing their harmful effects. I call that medication spellbinding. All these concepts are in the first half of my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. So my view is that the health professions across the board would actually produce vast public health gain simply by cutting back on and even eliminating the use of psychiatric drugs. It's really ironic, but if psychiatrists wanted to lead the way in improving the lives of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people, they could do it. They could do it by teaching people not to take drugs for a long period of time, teaching people how to wean themselves off drugs, how to get help for that, creating facilities for doing it. My book presents a...
Okay, Dr. Bregan, you've mentioned your book. Let's go to the information in the book. Now, besides antidepressants such as Paxil and Prozac, and antipsychotics such as Seroquel and Zyprexa, there are many other drugs known to be linked to suicide, and even acknowledged so by the FDA. There are anti-seizure drugs, the asthma drug Singulair, the anti-smoking drug Chantix, the anti-acne medication Accutane, and the malaria drug Lerin have all been linked to suicide. So shouldn't we, at some point, start looking at simply realizing that the American psychiatric community and most of its neurologists and the National Institutes of Mental Health are not going to break their ideology and go with a more natural approach? So how are we going to get people off these drugs that could cause suicide? And by the way, our research shows that 95% of all mass murders in the United States and Canada in the last 20 years have been on one of these drugs, one or more of these drugs, including Eric Harris and Bowling for Columbine. Your thoughts?
You know, I was an expert in a couple of lawsuits surrounding Eric Harris, and I can vouch for the fact the media is lying that Eric Harris was indeed on the antidepressive drug Luvox. You know, it just takes me back to everything you've been saying about life in general, Gary, that that foreign substances are generally not good for the body and the brain. And you gave a very accurate list of drugs that cause suicidal behavior. So why all these different drugs? Because when you put foreign chemicals into the brain, you don't know what you're going to get. You're causing multiple unpredictable biochemical imbalances, and a poorly functioning brain leads to a poorly functioning mind. It's not very, very complicated. You know, the approach that people need to take to withdrawing from psychiatric drugs begins with caution, because it's just as dangerous and at times more dangerous to come off the drugs than to start them, because your brain accommodates to the drug. And when you come off the drug, it's like being a severe alcoholic and stopping your alcohol, and you go into the DTs because your brain's been fighting the alcohol. It's all revved up. It goes into DTs from being revved up fighting the alcohol. Well, one way or another, the brain fights psychoactive substances. So you're always going to sort of be unmasking your brain's compensatory mechanisms when you stop the drug that has been driving the brain in new directions. And the second thing is, when you come off the drug, you're not going to be so numb, and you're going to feel more of the harm that's been done to you by the drug. You may realize that your sexuality has been suppressed, whereas before you didn't care. You may realize that your memory isn't working as good and you're not thinking as quickly, whereas on the drug you didn't realize it. So it's very important to have a support group when you come off, and to try to find a skilled clinician. And the point of the support group is that you may not notice horrible changes taking place in you during withdrawal. You may need a friend, a husband, somebody who's going to be seeing you every day, hopefully, and talking to you on the phone to say, well, Jack, you just don't sound so good tonight. You sound like you're really, really mad at your wife over nothing. Didn't the doctor tell you that coming off of Xanax or coming off of Lexapro could make you very angry? So maybe you better call the doctor and the prescriber or your therapist, or, you know, respond in a productive way to the fact you're going through withdrawal. One of the good things about withdrawal is that if you're having a withdrawal reaction, it's usually fixed within hours by going back to your previous dose. So if you've dropped your drug from 10 milligrams to 5 milligrams and you start to get weird, if you go right back up to the 10 milligrams, within an hour or two, you'll notice, whoa, am I better? That doesn't mean you need the drug. Anyone, the alcoholic person needs his alcohol. It means that you're going through a withdrawal reaction. So you, and my book gives you the various withdrawal reactions you can expect from each group of drugs, but in general, almost anything can happen during drug withdrawal. I'm hoping to convince prescribers to take it more seriously, because right now, most prescribers get personally offended when, and I think it is most, get personally offended when the patient asks if they can come off their meds. Prescribers need to know that the patients have good reasons, and patients' families have good reasons for wanting to come off these drugs.
Okay, Dr. Bregan, final question for you. Right now, being a child means you are in, you're in the fire zone, because Big Pharma sees a child from infant, toddler, teenager, they see you as an income stream. Providing that they can convince your parents and school teachers and the medical community that you're chemically imbalanced in your brain. So they've come up with all these absolutely bogus diagnoses, like, oh, like a social anxiety disorder or a mass
ADHD.
Yeah.
It's bogus.
Yeah. So why don't you take this final opportunity here, and then we're going to open this up for calls from our audience, and I'm going to give you that number in just a moment here so people can call in and ask Dr. Bregan or myself any question you would like. I'm going to ask Luke to give me that number, and then we'll give it to the people, and then you can call in. Why is it that we have allowed ourselves to feel that brain chemical imbalances, A, are real when they're not? There's no science behind them at all. And B, that all these diagnoses should be completely acceptable, which they shouldn't be. And then we start giving our kids drugs, and then the drugs make them agitated or underweight or hyper, or they can't eat or they can't sleep, or they become psychotic or dangerous. And we never once blame the drugs. Your thoughts?
Well, it's exactly what you've been talking about, Gary, and so many areas. The pharmaceutical industry infiltrates everything. In regard to drugging children, it's infiltrated the Department of Education, the National Institute of Mental Health. It sets up AstroTurf groups like CHAD and NAMI, which are supposed to be patient advocates but are drug company advocates. There's just a lot of money going into creating this market among children. I think years from now, it will be looked down on as a form of child abuse perpetrated not by the parents who are bamboozled, but perpetrated by the prescribers, and in particular the drug companies, and in particular the American Psychiatric Association. Children need parents. They don't need drugs. They need good nutrition. They need exercise. They need interesting schools. They need engaging teachers. They need ethical coaches. They need a spiritual orientation. And above all else, they need intense involvement in their lives from their parents. And one of the first things I see when a child is having a problem is usually the dad is either not in the family or not involved. It's not ADD, it's DADD, it's dad attention deficit disorder. The public just needs to say there are no shortcuts to the responsibility of raising kids. It's hard work. It's tough. It's probably the hardest job in the entire world, raising children. And we really need to dedicate our families and our schools to this and to not drug the kids who are showing rough edges because they're too smart for class, because they haven't been taught to read in class, because they haven't been fed properly on the way to school, because they're being bullied, because their parents haven't figured out a good routine for discipline. So really, we just need to wake up in America and take responsibility for our kids, Gary.
Well, you're doing a great job, and the book is called Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, a guide for prescribers, therapists, patients, and families. The website is toxicpsychiatry.com, and another website is empathetictherapy.org. Peter Bregan, thank you very much for being with us today, and all the best in getting people to wake up to this major, major issue.
And thanks for all your good work, Gary. Thank you.
Appreciate it. The number to call is 202-588-0893. Our lines are now open, 202-588-0893. I'm Gary Nall. We're here for the rest of the program to hear about your concerns and questions and comments and input. This is our talkback segment of our program. And as soon as we get your call up, we'll bring it right on. Here's the latest while the calls are coming in. As soon as I see the calls, I'll bring them online here. This is from commondreams.org, which is a good website. It says, report cites U.S. as example of the world's failing democracies. International Commission warns of growing influence of money in politics and attempts to suppress voter turnout. Quote, an international commission led by former U.N. Chief Kofi Annan warns that the world's democracies and the United States specifically are being corrupted by the increasing strong role of quote, uncontrolled, undisclosed, illegal, and opaque financing of political campaigns. The commission that put this together is staffed by former world leaders, Nobel Prize laureates, and they stipulated that powerful financial institutions and the surging influence of money in politics was harmful to both emerging and more developed democracies around the world. Quote, the rise of uncontrolled political finance, they say, threatens to hollow out democracy wherever and rob democracy of its unique strengths. That was from the Global Commission on Elections, Democracy and Security. Boy, they couldn't have been more right about that. Of course, no mention about that in the American media. Let's say hello to Jack. Hi, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. I have a question for you, kind of related to the last segment. How does one wean themselves from such drugs as Lexapro or even such drugs as Percocet? How can one wean themselves safely when one has built up a dependency on such a substance?
Well, you're talking about probably in the neighborhood of 40 million Americans, and it's a major epidemic. And what I suggest is, first and foremost, find out what are the actual effects, not just side effects, the actual effects of these drugs. And then, and you can do that through the physician's desk reference, then find yourself a support system. I'm going to suggest a holistic dietitian or nutritionist, a holistic neurologist, or a holistic psychiatrist, and you do have them in the Washington Metroplex area. So that's what I would suggest. That would be the route I would take. And that way you're not going to try to do it yourself. This is not something you should ever try to do yourself. Because as Dr. Bregan said, and he is correct, you start trying to go off Paxil on some of these, it's horrific. In fact, in a film that I did this last year called Death by Medicine, I followed a couple in the state of Washington where the woman, because of a loss of her father, and that was due to iatrogenic, a medically induced error in a hospital, went on an antidepressant. And then when she tried to get off the antidepressant, the next year, you see her going off. And it is scary. I gave him a camera after filming him, and I said, film every day. And the results are what it's like that the public never sees, what it's like trying to go off the drug. So do it with a holistic health team. All the best to you, Jack. Carrie, you're next. Hi, Carrie. You're on the air, Carrie. Please speak up. Okay. Luke, we don't seem to have Carrie there. Do we have someone else? See, you've got to turn off your radio because
Hello?
There's a delay. Yes, go ahead, please.
Is it my turn?
It is. Please turn off your radio.
Okay. Hello?
You're on the air.
Oh, I'm on the air. Okay. I'm sorry. They said Carrie. My name is Deborah.
Okay. You're on the air, Deborah.
Okay. Great. Hi, Gary. This is Deborah. It's such an honor and privilege to talk to you.
Thank you.
I have been receiving assistance from Luann Panazzi, and she saved my life. The smoothie protocol three times a day has helped me withdraw from several psychiatric medications. I'm only on one psychiatric medication right now, Depakote, and I'm currently locating a holistic psychiatrist, an orthomolecular psychiatrist, Dr. Warren Levin, here in Vienna, Virginia, and also Dr. Kogan, the Center for Integrated Medicine at DC. We've been working as a team together. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, what the next path is because we're still not clear as to what my situation is. You know, whether I should go with True Hope, which is a vitamin supplement company that helps with bipolar patients, or whether I need to still figure out my underlying physical causes for my symptoms.
Okay, let me answer, Deborah, because we have only a few minutes left, and I want to get some other calls on.
Okay.
First,
so I'm on Depakote. I was diagnosed as bipolar. I don't know if that was a misdiagnosis, but those were my...
There is no such thing as bipolar.
Okay, so how do I get
understand
off of
that?
What's the plan?
I have a new documentary coming out called Manufacturing Madness. I'll come down to Washington and play it when it's ready. I'll be down in Washington anyhow to do a lecture and premiere a new film in November. But I have in this film 12 of America's leading psychiatrists, all board certified. We took a completely normal, healthy, vibrant 35-year-old woman, as you will see, into each of their offices. And undercover, she was diagnosed with a different mental illness in each of the different 12 doctors' offices and given immediately a prescription for a very powerful antipsychotic or antidepressive medication. Later, when approached on the street and asked, you told this woman that she was this, 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 and that she should take this drug, yet she's completely normal, and you said that there's a brain chemical imbalance, could you show us the scientific literature, the peer-reviewed literature supporting this? Well, no, there's really no literature, there's no science, but, you know, you have to go based upon your gut. That's not what we see in the ads on television. We don't see someone putting an ad on television saying, well, there is no such thing as a brain chemical imbalance, and therefore buying our product from the doctor, you're just making us rich and you more suicidal. Because when a baby laughs and a baby cries within about a minute, they can be diagnosed with bipolar. It's a fraud. And you will see I challenge psychiatrists at their national convention. We also managed to get someone inside to film in there. Our entire mental health field is a fraud. We need a more compassionate, humanistic and holistic way of approaching this. I would not subscribe to any vitamin or vitamin line that purports to help people get this off or get them out of this. I suggest instead that you continue to do detoxing to rebalance your body's natural chemistry until your natural biochemistry is in harmony when you're in homeostasis. And that takes between 1 to 2 years to do if you're really doing it right. And Luann's a good provider of those protocols. So I'm glad that you're following her protocols, because she calls me every day to ask about protocols, and I'm up to date on a lot of the people she sees. I'm glad that you're one of them being helped. But don't take a shortcut. Don't think a vitamin is going to make a difference. At this point, it isn't. All the best to you, Deborah. Janice, you'll be our last call today, Janice.
Gary, what do you say to people who say that drugs have saved their lives?
Which drugs?
Well, I don't want to be specific, but antipsychotic or the SSRIs.
Well, you have to put this in perspective. When a person is going through a particularly rough time and they start acting out, especially if people have been using marijuana, you can go through psychotic episodes. I've seen this in my own friends who thought that marijuana was great, and I said, it's not. You know, you're confusing what's happening to your brain versus what's happening and how you feel. When they went off that, they went through these episodes. There are times when a person is in such an extremely agitated state that they represent a danger to themselves or other people. During that period of time, there may be a need for a short period of time for some form of tranquilizing agent. But that is rare compared to what most people are taking these antipsychotic and antidepressives for. And talk therapy, nutrition therapy, would be a much better and safer approach.
Thanks, Gary.
Okay. Thank you, Janice. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you for listening in. Now, beginning next week, one day out of the five that I'm here, you're going to be listening to what's called the Progressive Commentary Hour. Normally, you wouldn't be able to listen to it because it's on Monday evenings from 7 to 8 p.m. is when I record it. It's a very serious show. I take on one topic, and then I go into great depth on that topic with the world's leading experts on it. For example, the privatization of our prison system, or the war on drugs, and what kind of a fraud that is, and we shouldn't even have it. Why should we let these people out of prison? We should. You name the topic. If it's an important topic, the military-industrial complex and how they control everything and everybody. These are real serious topics that no major media will even touch. And that's where we go into depth. One day a week, expect to hear that. But every other day of the week, expect to hear health and nutrition, environmental information, something relevant to social issues, an important guest, and talk back where you have a chance to share your ideas. This is all part of bringing WPFW back to the level of significance and relevance that it had in its best years. This is one case where you're going to see a phoenix. I believe that PFW can rise if it's got good programming and if the audience tells other people. There's no advertising. The station is broke. Don't have a nickel. But you can talk. That's free advertising. And that's what causes people to pay attention and listen. So please, if you believe that this show or any other program you hear on PFW is important to you, let someone else know. And that way we can have just one more voice and one more listener, and one more person to support its important missions. Have a nice weekend, everyone. I'll see you back here on Monday.